This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 237, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And just so you know, my book titled Aspects of Alien Abduction has been published, and you can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle on Amazon. This week, I'm talking to Steve Aspin and Andreas Luck about their book, Investigating the Impossible. Biology offers new answers and insights. Steve has had encounters with non-human intelligence throughout his life. Dr. Andreas Luck is a cellular biologist, geneticist, and co-author of Investigating the Impossible. He holds a PhD and MSc degrees in molecular biology, biochemistry, and genetics, and spent 3 years postdoctoral research work at Harvard University. Hi, Steve and Andreas. Thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast.
Hi, Simon. Good to hear you again.
Yeah. Hi, Simon. Nice to be here again.
So we're talking about your book. It's called Investigating the Impossible. Biology offers new answers and insights. And last time you were here, we talked about the Nazca mummies. But there's so much more in your book, and I got a million questions left over. The first thing I wanted to ask about was this idea of hybrids and whether it's, you know, biologically possible, theoretically, to do that. But before we get into it, could you like give us an overview of the hybrid phenomenon?
Well, it's been reported by abductees or experiences, whatever particular description you want to give these people. I know that you've written a book compiling loads of these experiences that have just been published in May, so you're very familiar with the territory. It's been reported by thousands of these people over decades that they interact with types of beings during their abduction that looks like a cross between an alien species and a human species. And later they interacted with beings that looked exactly like us. In other words, they were the human in every detail, but they seemed to be in some way serving the alien agenda, because they seem to have admittedly weakened but evidentially present abilities of speaking to the abductees telepathically and being able to control their actions or thoughts or influence their actions or thoughts at will and render them unable to run away or calm them down or something. So this phenomenon, interactions with hybrid or transgenic beings, which is what we talk about in the book, is a persistent theme of the UAP abduction issue for several decades, and it won't go away. It continues to be reported by more and more people. So Andreas will tell you a brief history of how he was asked to investigate this particular phenomenon and what really is going on, and whether we can work out what might be going on here.
Yeah, the way I was first approached by to get into this topic, in particular the hybrids, was when Hillebrand von Ludwiger, the late president of my organization that I'm a part or member of, which is called IGAP, IGAAP, and a couple of years ago when he was still alive, he asked me, well, Andreas, you're a molecular biologist, and we have all these reports from abductees and experiences that claim to have encountered those beings that partly look like us, partly look like them. Can you do me a favor and can you investigate that? So it took me about a year and a half to conduct some investigation into that, which is about, I would say halfway to two-thirds of what we present in the book. And, at first, it did seem a little bit odd to have hybrid beings between an extraterrestrial species and humans. So I started to dig deeper, and I encountered the books written by David Jacobs, And he has five categories of hybrid beings, so to speak, called phases 1 through 5. In phase one, these beings look pretty much like Steve described a moment ago, about halfway alien and halfway humans. In phase two, they already look a little more human, but still alien enough so that one could say, okay, we have more or less a true hybrid here. In phases 3 through 5, the physical characteristics of the alien species are more and more gone, and in phases 4 and 5, they're completely gone. Phase 5, actually, David Jacobs calls or termed hubrid, HUBRID, not hybrid, and that for a good reason. As Steve also pointed out a moment ago, these beings are completely undistinguishable from any other human, from humans, so they look exactly like us.
I just wanted to interject there that Jacob said that he'd been told by many of the abductees who worked with him that these ultra human-looking ones specifically told him that the objective of their existence, the purpose of their existence, is to live here with us full time. That's their purpose. In all the other stages of hybridization that you outlined, in the other stages, that's not the case. They're not living here. They just come in and out, or they're only met during the e-abduction experiences. But this specific category of beings that look exactly human and talk to behave like exactly human, their job is to live here and integrate with us and our society.
Okay, that's a different part of the whole hybrid issue. And if we have enough time, we may actually ad address that particular point a little bit later in the discussion. But for now, there are a couple of questions. First is, what actually are the biological prerequisites from both species that must be met in order to actually be? Or to actually deliver a hybrid being. And there are a couple, there's a whole number of prerequisites. For example, the biochemistry of the other species must be based on the element carbon, just like our biochemistry is entirely based on the element carbon. Then there has to be the same type of genetic material, which is DNA, which is RNA, and so forth. So there is a whole set of prerequisites that must be met, also in the other species. If they are not met, then it stops right there. There will be no hybrid beings if those prerequisites are not met. But even if they are met, then we have a whole lot of other issues that must be considered by the, in quotation marks, extraterrestrial gene engineers, so to speak. Question mark closing. Quotation mark closing, sorry. So there is, for example, cell division, mitosis. There is meiosis, the generation of germ cells. There is the issue of fertilization. That's a very big issue. There are those individuals or those authors and TV shows that propagate, and then the extraterrestrial came down from the skies. They had sex with human women, and then those women would deliver hybrid beings, like in the ancient Greek and Roman mythologies, the giants, but also described in the Bible. And it's not quite that simple. Steve, you want to add to that?
No, I just think that it's the references of this specifically in the Bible are in the very early part of the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis, and that they say the Nephilim were born of human women, and you can sometimes call the angels or the gods who interbred with them. So, you know, that will be the way it's translated from the original Hebrew. The Nephilim were giant people.
That's correct. But more recent, then we have authors like Eric von Däniken, who is the founder of the ancient pre-astronautic society, and who also claims that the extraterrestrials came down from with their spaceships, and they had sex with human women, and then the hybrid beings would be born as offspring. And along those lines. But if you really look into the biology, things are much more complicated, a hell of a lot more complicated. And there must be a whole set of things be considered and taken into account and overcome. One of them is the fertilization issue. For example, the way Eric von Däniken propagates, then they had sex. Well, it doesn't work like that. First of all, the sexual organs must be compatible, which means, in a manner of speaking, the male sex, their primary sexual characteristic, the penis in humans, would have to fit into the human vagina of the woman. If that's not the case, then the story ends right there. But assuming for a moment even that it does work, then the next thing is the fertilization. Fertilization is when sperm meets an oocyte and the genetic material of those two germ cells fuse, and from there a zygote is being produced, and from there a new living being is being is grows, and then it sees the light of the day within a couple of months, in the human case, 9 months later. The fertilization issue is more complicated. Around there's the oocyte, and around the oocyte is a layer of biological material that is a protective shield of sort. It's a little bit more like well, slime, if you want. And the sperm must actively work its way through that zone layer, which is called the zona pellucida. And in order to do that, the sperm, human sperm, has in its tip, there is a vesicle, and this vesicle is filled with enzymes. And those enzymes, when the sperm hits the oocyte, the vesicle is being released, and the enzymes are being released, and they actively dismantle that protective layer. But even that is not the end of the story. A second step must also be met, and that is two membrane proteins. One is called Juno, and the other one is called Izumo-1, must meet, and they work like in a key and lock principle. Only the perfect, correct Izumo-1 protein can actually meet with the correct Juno protein, and then, and only then, the genetic material of the sperm, the DNA, is being released into the oocyte. When that happens, a zygote is being created, and out of that zygote, it's a one cell which now has the, again, diploid chromosomal set, like it's always has to be. And now all we need is mitosis, the regular cell division, and from there, a living organism grows and is being born within a couple of months. But even so, there is more to that. With mitosis, it's the regular cell division. There has to be, when one cell division is finished, a certain amount of time has to pass until the next mitosis can be initiated. There's a good reason for that, and that period of time that is needed in order to start the second mitosis after the end of the first one is called the cell cycle. The cell cycle is divided into interphase and the actual mitosis, and the interphase is then being subdivided into three other portions called G1 or GAP1, S for synthesis, and G2 for GAP2. In the G1 phase, the cell is physiologically active and undergoes most of the biochemical energy and metabolism that will produce building blocks for biomolecules like proteins and for growth in particular. In S phase, the DNA is duplicated. The S phase in humans takes about 8 hours, and during those 8 hours, the 3 billion base pairs are being reduplicated, and G2, the GAP2 phase, is mostly concerned with control of the S phase, that everything has been reduplicated correctly. Errors and mistakes, where if and when detected, will be corrected. And then once the G2 phase comes to its end, and only then the next mitosis will be able to happen. And then the whole thing repeats itself as long as growth or wound healing or whatever needs to be done with mitosis needs to be completed. Another issue would be the individual development. For example, limb development, which is legs and arms. And for that, we have to have a very specific biochemical procedure that needs to be followed. I don't want to explain that in much detail here, but there is a couple of so-called morphogenic factors being involved. Morphogenic factors are proteins that are synthesized in one area of the developing limb bud, and they diffuse out. And while diffusing out, we have a region where it's a high concentration of that particular protein, and then we have regions farther away where there is a low concentration. It's a gradient. And this gradient is crucial for the development of the specific limb bud. If that is not the case, then there will be misformations and malformations in individual development. We have also the issue of differentiation. You see, once the initial stage is the zygote, and the initial 10 or 15 cell divisions of the zygote will not deliver any kind of specific tissue. But at some point, differentiation needs to set in and will set in. It's a highly controlled, genetically controlled mechanism that in the end will develop organs like brain, stomach, liver, intestines, groins, testicles, and everything just like that. The thing is, once a cell has entered a specific path of differentiation, there is no turning back. So it can only move forward. And in the end, when it reaches its final differentiation stage, there is nothing else that a cell can be as it is. No turning back, no turning sideways. That also needs to be considered by the ETs if they want to create hybrid beings. Then there is the issue of communication between cells and within cells, between organ systems that are quite far away. And part of that is managed and accomplished by hormones. Part of that is accomplished by other factors. And part of that is accomplished within the cell by even other molecules. All that needs to be addressed and taken into account if anyone would want to create a hybrid being from two biologically not in the least bit related species.
So would you say that actually it just seems impossible? But I suppose on the other side of it, we just don't know how advanced their technology is.
Yes, Simon, that's a comment, that a statement that I hear all the time. We don't know what they're technically accomplished or what they can technically accomplish. And yes, it's true. But what is also true is that human biology cannot be simply overridden, because all the processes that I just described have been developed over millions and millions and millions of years. They have been through a high pressure selection in evolution, and they have been perfected. Just as an example, if you there are these, everything is let in the end, everything is molecules, and these molecules interact with one another in a specific way, and that's the way they do interact, and there is no other way, and there is no way of just disrupting that whole system and yet still accomplish what cannot be done normally without the proper procedures. To answer your question, it does seem to be impossible. It's pretty much impossible given the idea that you want to create a true hybrid being. And here we come back to David Jacobs and his five phases of hybrid beings, in quotation marks. I was wondering why is it that the stages 3, 4, and 5, especially 4 and 5, so-called hybrid beings, do not show any kind of physical characteristic from the other species? That is something that biologically is not possible if you actually do want to create a true hybrid being. I'll give you an example. A horse and a donkey, they can be crossed and the offspring would be a mule. A mule clearly shows physical characteristics from both species, from horse and also from donkey. They are perspectives sterile, which means they cannot produce viable offspring. That has to do with the faulty meiosis, which is caused by the number of chromosomes within the body cells of mules, which is an uneven number. And you see, in meiosis, there is one cell at the beginning, and at the end, the germ cells are four. So you have to divide your genomic genetic material into four different cells evenly, so that each of those four different cells carries the same number of chromosomes. Horses have 64 chromosomes in their body cells. Donkeys have 62. So if you go and look at the germ cells, each germ cell has half of the number of chromosomes like a regular body cell, which means horses, you have 32, and for donkeys, you have 31 chromosomes in each germ cell. Now, if these two germ cells from horse and donkey meet and they create a mule, then the resulting diploid cell carries 63 chromosomes in a body cell of a mule. Now, try to divide those 63 chromosomes evenly onto four different cells. It's not possible because it's an uneven number. That is why the mule cannot have offspring. Coming back to the initial point, my question was that I asked myself, why is it that they don't show any kind of physical characteristics of the other species? None at all in the more advanced stages. And the answer is most likely because they are not hybrids. They are perfectly human. Now, you can say, okay, but what about stage one, where they really look like half and half? True, but that, in my personal opinion, this is a prototype. And they most likely came soon to realize that they cannot override more human biology just like that, with something like a magic wand, and all of a sudden human biology doesn't exist anymore. So most likely they came to realize that it's not that simple, and maybe it's nearly next to impossible to create a true hybrid being. And maybe that wasn't even the intention, because as Steve pointed out, the type 5 hybrids, the hybrids, have the expressed purpose and task to live on this planet and to be integrated as part of regular human societies and not stand out with like a sore thumb. So then the question is, what are they? If they are not true hybrids, the answer is the only other alternative or explanation is they are transgenics. Transgenics are individuals or species, beings that are perfectly normal as in within their species. For humans, they are human, but they have one or maybe a few additional genes implanted into them. Most likely at the stage of the zygote, the genetic manipulation, and that makes them look like humans, but they are not quite human. And this is most likely what those type 5 or phase 5 hybrids, the hybrids, are. What are the genes that they could potentially carry extra? I have no idea. What I could explain, if you want, is how most likely they actually will be transformed or become those transgenic individuals.
I don't know if it's an assumption that the Greys have evolved on another planet, so they don't have DNA or they're so different from us. But at the same time, they're the same shape as us, aren't they? With a head and two arms and two legs. Which would that suggest that perhaps in some way they're related to us?
Not necessarily. I was asking me the same question before, and I have no proof, no evidence, no nothing. It's just an idea. That particular humanoid or shape that we have, two legs, two arms, and a head stuck in the middle of the between two shoulders, could for some reason be a preferred shape or anatomy, if you want, or morphology, if you want, even outside of this planet. It doesn't have to be limited to Earth. And you're right, if they have evolved on a different planet, then the genetic material most likely is not exactly the DNA that we have. You're perfectly right with that.
So could it be a thing almost like for life to evolve somewhere, DNA is a universal constant across the whole universe? Like life can't exist if it doesn't have DNA.
I cannot completely rule that out, I have to admit, Simon. And from a biological point of view and from a, let's say, heart science point of view in general, you have to imagine the number of circumstantial happenings, but by chance happenings on other planets to create exactly the same molecule like DNA, atom for atom, and each of those atoms is at the same, the very same position like in human DNA. The chance for that, the probability for that to have happened to happen just by chance is next to zero. Simply for the reasons. Let me go a little bit into the physics here now for a moment. First of all, there is the star. We have different types of stars, red ones, yellow ones, white ones. We have dwarf stars. We have brown ones and so forth. Then we have planets rotating around that particular star. And depending on the distance of this particular planet from its star, it's either in the habitable zone or it's not. Is it a planet like Earth, or is it more like a planet like Jupiter, a gas giant? All of that depends on the specific physical conditions of that particular star system. Then there are other issues. What about even if the planet would be positioned in the habitable zone, it still, does it have any water? What about gravity? What about plate tectonics and the whole nine yards? You see what I'm aiming for? It's each planet is different. There is no other planet in this universe that is exactly like Earth that we live on. That is not, simply not happening. So coming back to your initial question, is it possible that DNA is the universal constant in the universe? I cannot completely rule it out, but in my opinion, it's next to impossible, almost zero, not quite zero, because nobody really knows that, and nobody can actually know that at this moment in time. But the chances for that, exactly that, are quite minimal.
So what about this thing of, in alien abduction accounts, that it's a multi-generational thing, that maybe your grandparents, your parents, and then you, and they may be, I don't know, doing something over the generations to make hybridization or transgenesis more likely?
Yes, I hear what you're saying, but that's probably a different plan even, or a different project of the other species. Because what they seem to be doing there is they alter existing genes in humans, and they trace those changes through generations within families. You see, I've been working as a geneticist in a laboratory in Boston at the Harvard Medical School, and we used to work with mice, and we would change the genetics of those mice, and then we would trace the changes through offspring for 3, 4, 5 generations. And that seems to be exactly the same pattern that we did in the lab in Boston that they do with us, only in their case, we are the mice and not the other way around. So in a way, so they change existing genes. For what purpose, I have no idea. But of course, I have some thoughts. Well, basically, in many cases, or in some cases at least, when abductees are being transported to those spaceships or wherever these facilities are that they use, they're being shown, for example, thermonuclear wars or environmental pollution and so forth. We humans have a history of destroying our own Earth to destroy the resources that we need to survive. And one of the ideas, and that's part of that, is biochemically speaking, caused by a hormone, a steroid hormone that is called testosterone. Testosterone is responsible for a large degree of human aggression and other negative behaviors, violence, and so forth. So in that context, if you put these two things together, those things that the abductees are being shown while on those spaceships about environmental pollution, thermonuclear wars, and so forth. And the testosterone issue, then it would make sense. I have no proof, but it would make sense if someone, if they would try to minimize the amount of testosterone in the human body. Completely eliminating testosterone is not possible, because in men, it's mostly responsible for the primary sexual characteristics in men, which means testicles and penis. But also even in women, testosterone has a certain biochemical function. So completely take it out of the human's biology is not possible.
So what about this idea that what they're doing, they seem to be succeeding in it from what the witnesses say, but could it be that what they're doing is very fragile and not very stable? So over time, it just degrades, and they're not the hybrids, so to speak, aren't able to procreate.
If hybrids are able to have offspring, I don't know. Steve, did you ever hear about that?
Certainly, they mate with humans, right, with abductees. But the interesting thing is, in all the abduction reports, we don't know of any instance, or we don't know of any instance where these hybrids ever mate with each other. They are not attracted to each other, so they seem to be redesigned to only interact with humans in that way. And we know that the females do, and the males they interact with male humans, and the male humans, male transgenics interact with female humans, because there are many, many reports of those cases. But I'm not sure if any of these matings result in offspring or are successful. With lots of abductees who have been exposed to these situations and have fairly clear memory recall, say that the one thing about the female, the so-called hybrids or the transgenics, is they don't appear to be able to conceive. No matter who they mate with, they don't be able to conceive. So that seems to be a shortcoming in the state of the biology as it's been engineered. They just don't seem to be able to do it. Whether the male hybrids or transgenics can produce a fertile sperm with good motility that can mate with a human, we actually don't know that either, because although some female abductees claim they give birth to star children or whatever, I don't think there's any biological evidence that happens. Or there's no biological evidence that we can trust, you know, that validates that happens in reality.
Okay, that would actually support one of my other ideas, that they need to continue to produce those hybrids quite likely indefinitely, because just exactly for that particular reason that Steve just pointed out, they may not be able to have viable offspring for reasons completely unknown. And if that is the case, then the alien species, in order to meet their goal with the master plan behind everything, is that they need to continuously produce hybrids, bring them on this planet, and eventually actually reach both, that both my plans are being successful. The first one, eliminating quite likely the violent behavior out of the human species, and the other one, have the hybrids take over or undermine or something like that, the human societies take over quite likely political positions eventually, and we don't know exactly who is a hybrid and who is not. And in the end, work kind of like against humanity and in favor of the other alien species.
Sounds quite sinister, doesn't it? I've got an idea that comes from my other work that I do with past life regression and looking for evidence that consciousness survives death. I'm wondering if what they're doing is a good thing. I'm not saying this is definitely happening, it's just an idea. The hybrids are like an upgrade for the human race, so that when we incarnate in those bodies, we're more likely to be more spiritual, I suppose. They inherit some of the abilities of the greys, it seems, to do with ESP and things. So that was just an idea I had.
Yeah, but those abilities could quite likely be transmitted through those extra genes, the genes that they are received to be transgenic. I will give you an example of what transgenesis really means. And it's a quite simple example. There is the species pig, P-I-G, and they look exactly like pigs. And in the late 1980s, I think, there was in the agricultural industry, there was some genetic manipulation done to some of those pigs. And they, in the end, they were termed Euro pigs. And what they received was just one extra gene, and that extra gene coded for a growth factor. And this one extra gene in that pig led to a situation that it had so much body mass built up on top of the normal body mass by means of the activity of that particular growth factor gene, that it was so heavy, his legs would not support its weight.
And that's just one gene?
That is just one gene. That is just one simple gene for one growth factor led to that particular situation that the pig couldn't move. It, many of them actually, just from standing, they would collapse under their own weight.
You've got a thing from Reddit in the book with an anonymous biologist who claimed to have worked on the bodies of recovered aliens. And when you look at what he's written there, does it make sense to you?
On first glance, yes, it does, but only on first glance. And only you actually can dismantle that whole thing only if you have very, very deep knowledge about biology. When I read this post first, Steve actually sent it to me, and he asked me to look it over and tell him if that's plausible or not. On first reading, I thought to myself, okay, maybe it's possible. Then I read it four more times. And each time I read it again, I realized and discovered big mistakes and just sometimes simple nonsense that was written in that post. So, but it's quite difficult to peel away those multiple layers of disinformation that's in the particular post to actually get to the ground of it.
Another thing I wanted to ask: I was taken through a past life regression in December, and I asked him to investigate if I've had any contacts with greys, because I've seen UFOs close up, and these memories did pop up. And one of them was that I was lying back on this table, this tall grey came over and put its face maybe an inch from mine, and it felt like it was looking into my brain, into my mind, looking through my thoughts and emotions and memories. And you've got that in the book, which I think you call Mind Scan. And what do you think's happening there?
We have different ideas about this.
Yeah.
Very different.
Yeah, indeed.
Well, there's a lot of testimony from abductees, their abduction experience. Those who are aware of they've had such experiences, they always report that, first of all, some of the things they say would explain the missing time phenomenon. Like many of your listeners will be familiar with the missing time phenomenon. It's where someone is, say, in the living room, and they get up to put the kettle on and make a cup of coffee, and suddenly they find themselves displaced. They might be in a different room, or they might be on the other side of the room, and the light outside is different. It's got dark, and they just feel that something really strange happened, and then they look at the clock and it's 2 hours later than it was a second ago. This time just vanishes. And when abductees are taken during their sleep, that this is not so noticeable. The abductors can take people in their sleep and take them away for 2 or 3 hours and then turn them to the bed. When the abductee wakes up, they don't actually notice the missing time, because, you know, in a state of sleep, you don't actually notice missing time, but they just feel more tired in the morning, and they just feel like they're in a very strange night and something very odd might have happened. But what abductees report sometimes in these encounters is when they're lying on the table having procedures performed on them, at the end of the whole process, one of the tall grey aliens, because there are two types they have a very similar morphology, but the taller ones are about 5 foot or 5'6" tall, and the shorter ones are not quite half that height, but they're no taller than 3 feet. You get about 2'6" or 3 feet. So you can convert that into centimeters. You know, it's about 70 centimeters tall. So the one of the taller ones who tends to do these mental procedures, and they're very complex physical medical procedures, they will put their face over the top of the abductee's face, and they twist their head around, and all they can see is one gigantic eye. That they usually describe the alien's face is eyes as being either black or very 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 deep shade of dark brown. And then sometimes they see something moving in their eye, but like a little blue light that seems to wiggle around. And it moves his or her head around. Sometimes they walk around the table and they get their eye within a few millimeters sometimes of the abductee's eye. And the abductee reports that they feel something suddenly happens. And what you described, Simon, that's a few minutes ago, that they feel that their brain is being read or being invaded, and they feel all sorts of emotions go through them like a shock. Some of them feel great sexual desire. Some of them feel fear. Some of them feel anger or anxiety. Some of them feel a sense of universal oneness or bliss or an amazing physical relaxation. There's a whole range of emotions that they describe. That what's been happening is that the alien is somehow triggering these emotions through the eye contact. So what happens? Sometimes the alien will say telepathically to them, "You're not going to remember anything that's happened in the past 2 hours, or you're not going to remember any of this." And so when the abductee basically is returned to their normal circumstance, they just feel this big chunk of time is missing. And what it seems that they seem to do is they place the experience of those 2 or 3 hours into the abductee's long-term memory. And this staring, sometimes called a staring procedure, where they engage through the eye-to-eye contact, they engage through the optic nerve it may be they do that. It seems they may do that because that goes straight into the abductee's brain. They seem to have an astounding natural ability, or it might be an engineered ability, engineered into them, that they are able to place that period of time into the abductee's long-term memory. So in order to recover it, you have to be able to learn, you have to teach yourself to remember things that, say, if you're 55 years old, you try and remember one day in your life when you're six, and it might not be it might be a birthday or a Christmas day or something like that. Those dates tend to stand out in people's lives. But it might be just an ordinary day, one day when, you know, relatives visited you, or you went on a trip somewhere, and you train your mind, you train your memory to yield up the information about that day, what the weather was like, what you were wearing, what people said to you, whether you felt happy, whether it was warm, the kind of clothes you're wearing on that day, you know, the size of your feet and so forth, if you're a child. And if you recall in detail that those kind of details, you're training your long-term memory. You're training yourself to access your long-term memory. And if you train yourself over time to do that, you can usually better remember your abduction experiences if you trained your memory to work in those ways. Andreas doesn't think the eye-to-eye contact or the optic nerve contact is responsible for this. He thinks it's done a slightly different way. Maybe you'd like to talk about that, Andreas.
Yeah, of course. So my idea about accessing the human brain and from there the entire human body, that staring procedure, I think the gray that hovers just maybe centimeters over your eye is you trying to adjust its or synchronize your brain waves or his brain waves with your brain waves. It's a fact that our brain emits electromagnetic radiation of sort of brain waves. And those brain waves can be manipulated in certain ways that you actually start hallucinating. That can be done in different ways. And the brain waves can actually be measured, and it's done even today in neurological clinics or something like that by doing an EEG. So the gray hovering over your face is trying to adjust its brain waves with, or synchronize its brain waves with your brain waves. And once that is accomplished, it automatically, instantly gets access to not only to your brain, but to your entire body. Because the brain is the big control center for voluntary things and involuntary things. That's all controlled by the brain. And elucidating such feelings like Steve described, from sadness all the way to I love this staring gray just in front of me, can be done by manipulating brain waves. So that is my explanation. And from a biological point of view, Steve's explanation accessing the optic nerve is way too complicated, because in order to do that, first of all, that alien somehow must gain access to your retinal cells. Those retinal cells then need to produce a biochemical reaction that in the end is being converted even within that very same cell to a electrical impulse and then back to a biochemical reaction, because those retinal cells are connected to nerve cells. And the only way, there's some tissues, but not in the brain, not in the optic nerve, the transmission of a signal from one cell to the next, from a sensory cell to a nerve cell is being done by means of a chemical called a neurotransmitter. That neurotransmitter is being produced from the cell that carries the information or the impulse, then being transmitted to the next cell. The receiving cell is an optic nerve cell. And there's this neurotransmitter which must diffuse through the synaptic cleft and bind to a receptor molecule, a protein, in the membrane of the nerve cell. And from there, it's being converted again into an electric impulse, which then gets all the way through the brain into the optic cortex, which is located at the back of the brain. But there it stops, and it doesn't automatically, from the optic cortex, get automatic access to the rest of the brain or the body.
But how does it make the abduction experience? Where does the missing time come from? Because this is this phenomenon is pretty much universally reported.
I don't disagree with that, not at all. All I'm saying is that the way the gray gets access to your brain, to your emotions, is a different one. The outcome is the same.
The book's called Investigating the Impossible: Biology Offers New Answers and Insights, and people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Yes, indeed, and other high street shops. If your audience is predominantly British, they can buy it at Waterstones and other outlets. In any German speakers in your audience, we're producing a German language edition of Out of Time. Investigating the Impossible. Towards the end of the summer, is currently in publication. It will be on the market in a couple of months.
Fantastic. And thanks again.
Bye now.
Thank you.
And that was an interview with Steve Aspin and Dr. Andreas Luck about their book, Investigating the Impossible: Biology Offers New Answers and Insights. And my book, titled Aspects of Alien Abduction, is on Amazon. You can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. And if you enjoy this episode, please leave a review, and thanks for listening.